Alors, je ne sais pas si je dois présenter vraiment Svante Paabo, parce que c'est un chercheur extrêmement célèbre, extrêmement connu, qui est directeur d'un des départements de l'Institut Max Planck d'anthropologie évolutive à Leipzig, et qui dirige le département de génétique. Il est mondialement connu pour ses travaux sur le génome, en particulier des Néandertaliens. Et donc, je ne vais pas prendre beaucoup plus sur son temps. Je vais lui laisser la parole et le remercier de nous faire le plaisir d'être avec nous ce soir. Merci.
Well, thank you very much, Jean-Jacques, for inviting me here. I'm very pleased to be here. I've only been here once before at this very august institution. So what I then wanted to do over the next 50 minutes or so is to talk to you about our efforts to retrieve the genomes, the genetic material, from our closest extinct relatives. You hear me in the back? You'll have to tell me if it doesn't work. And I would then just like, and towards the end, more talk about what we have learned about studying these genomes and what we might learn in the future by using these genomes. But I wanted to just start out by reminding you all about the fact that you already know, that our genetic material is stored in all cells in our body, almost all cells in our body, and that information is stored sort of twice, once on each strand in the sequence of these four nucleotides abbreviated A, T, C, and G. And as you also know, it's really important that information is there twice, because whenever the genome divides, when a new cell should emerge, these strands come apart and new ones are synthesized with the old as a template. This process is very exact, but sometimes, of course, errors are made. Sometimes an incorrect nucleotide or base is built in. And if that is not repaired quickly enough, it will be inherited to the daughter cell as a mutation. And if that happens in a germline, it will be a mutation that appears in the new individual that is born. So every baby that's born carries somewhere in the order of 100 or 200 new mutations that is not there in the mother nor in the father. And these mutations, the traces of them or the results of them, we can see if we compare a DNA sequence in the population. So if we compare two genomes in this room, we find a difference between two individuals approximately once every 1,000 nucleotides. And since these mutations rain down on our genome in each generation, if we then go on and compare ourselves to a chimpanzee, we will find more such differences, about one every 100 nucleotides. And if we're then interested in the evolution, the history of a piece of DNA or a genome, we use these differences to reconstruct the history of the genomes. And in this case, it's really simple. These two human genomes go back to a common ancestor rather recently, have about one difference every 1,000 nucleotides. If we go to the common ancestor with the chimpanzee, we have about 10 times more differences, so we're much further back in the time. And you also know that our genome is about 3 billion such nucleotides, so we have something in the order of 3 million differences between two genomes. So there is a lot of variation there to help us reconstruct our genomic history. And if we now do that on a worldwide scale, what one then finds is that we have most genetic variation in Africa. And if we take the entire world outside Africa, although there are a lot more people, of course, who live outside Africa than inside Africa, we have less genetic variation there. And not only that, the genetic variants we find outside Africa generally have closely related variants inside Africa. But there is a proportion of the variation in Africa then that has no close relatives outside Africa. So the interpretation from that pattern is then that modern humans, the direct ancestors of present-day people, evolved in Africa, accumulated genetic variation there, and a part of that variation, so to say, went out and colonized the rest of the world. And with some genetic tricks, for example, by seeing over how long distances on chromosomes you have these sort of patterns you see outside and inside Africa, you can estimate approximately when that happened. And it's sort of less than 100,000 years ago when this exodus out of Africa started. So that is sort of the genetic evidence for the recent African origin of modern humans that one sees. But there is then a problem with this idea, if you like, saying that modern humans evolve in Africa, come out, and colonize the rest of the world. And that is what Jean-Jacques Hublin had talked to you about, that there are other forms of humans that exist, also in Eurasia, that go back almost 2 million years. And most well-known, of course, are more recent forms of humans in Western Eurasia, the Neanderthals, and in Eastern Eurasia, other forms that are less well known. So a big interest in our group have since 20 years been, what happened to these groups? Did they contribute genetically to people today? How are we related to them? But the problem is, of course, that they are extinct, so you will have to then try to retrieve DNA from old remains. And that work goes back over 30 years in the meantime, started out by studying ancient Egyptian mummies back in the 80s, where in some mummies you can see, for example, here in the skin and the basal levels of the skin of a 2,300-year-old mummy, structures that look like cell nuclei where DNA would be preserved. And you can also show stain these for DNA, so there is DNA preserved. Back at that time, I then went on to clone that DNA and actually sequence it and show that it was human DNA preserved there. But we just thought it was preserved. In reality, what one didn't realize at that time was that this type of work is very prone to contamination. So most likely the DNA sequences I determined back then were DNA sequences from myself and not at all from the mummy. So the sequences you should not believe. Because what then have turned out is that, of course, in such old remains, there is very little DNA preserved. In the order of 100,000 or a millionfold less DNA per gram of tissue than they would have from fresh tissues. In addition, there are chemical modifications in it, and the vast majority of all the DNA in such a specimen doesn't come from the individual itself, but from bacteria and microorganisms that have colonized the tissues after death. And this then means that also small amounts of contamination of present-day DNA that may enter your experiments, that will not show up at all if you study present-day DNA, can sort of totally overwhelm your results here and dominate what you see. So this led then over 20 years to more and more sort of paranoia of cleanliness, where you start wearing funny clothes when you do your experiments, work in separate laboratories, sterilize all reagents and instruments you use, and so on. And it also resulted in that one focused one's work not on the nuclear genome, but on a tiny part of the genome localized outside the cell nucleus, the mitochondrial genome. It's a tiny piece of DNA. It's inherited only from mothers to offspring, so it reflects only the female side of history. And the advantage of it, though, is that it occurs in many copies per cell. So there are hundreds, sometimes thousands of copies of mitochondrial DNA per cell, whereas in the nuclear genome, there are just two copies, of course, the genome you inherited from your mother and from your father. So one has then used these techniques to go back in time, study zoological collections, more recently extinct animals that became extinct in the last 100 or 200 years, such as the marsupial wolf in Australia, animals that disappeared in the last during the last glaciation, such as ground sloths or mammoths. But what is our big interest are then particularly the Neanderthals. So the Neanderthals then appear. I sort of hardly dare say anything here, but depending, I guess, on how you define a Neanderthal, maybe somewhere 300,000-400,000 years back in time, and live to somewhere between 30,000 or 40,000 years ago when they become extinct. And to the left, you see a sort of reconstructed Neanderthal skeleton compared to a modern human skeleton. And there have been different ideas around what happened when modern humans then come out of Africa. One idea was a total replacement, where Neanderthals become extinct in Europe with no mixture at all. Asian forms also, no mixture at all with modern humans. And the other idea is that, yes, Neanderthals become extinct, but they contribute a bit to the genetic variation of Europeans today. And you can, of course, imagine anything from 0% contribution to quite a bit of contribution here. So the first chance then to test this with genetic means came in the mid-90s, when we got access to the Neanderthal type specimen. So this is the specimen that was found in 1856 in Neanderthal in Western Germany and gave its name to this group of hominins. Looked at a sample from the humerus there, focused then on this mitochondrial DNA, a particular variable part of it, very cumbersomely with the techniques of the time, retrieved short pieces many times over, reconstructing a longer piece of DNA, believing the substitutions that you repeatedly saw there. And if you then estimate such a tree of the relationship of the mitochondrial DNA then with present-day humans, the picture was very clear. All present-day human mitochondrial DNAs go back to a common ancestor 100, 200,000 years ago. Much further back, 500,000 years or a bit more, is a common ancestor shared also with the Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA. Since then, we and others have looked at many other Neanderthal mitochondrial DNAs, and this is a consistent picture. So it's very clear there are no humans today that run around with a mitochondrial DNA from a Neanderthal. So in this scheme then, it's total replacement. But it's also clear, as I have stressed, that the mitochondrial DNA is a very small part only of the genome, and that the big complete picture would be in the nuclear genome. And the chance to sort of start at least dreaming about studying the nuclear genome of the Neanderthal really came in the early years of this millennium, when new techniques came around to sequence millions and billions of DNA molecules rapidly and quite inexpensively. So you could then start thinking about extracting the total DNA from such a specimen, sequencing all the DNA that's hiding in the bone, make a little data bank, and start comparing that data bank to the human genome that was now sequenced to see which molecules of DNA there might come from the Neanderthal. The first place where this worked was in Croatia, a beautiful site called Vindija, from this bone that may be around 40,000 years old. And we were then very lucky to get funding to improve over 5 years our techniques with which we extract the DNA from the bones and modify them to a sort of form that can be fed into these sequencing machines. So we got a lot better with that, the machines got better. And one of the things we then discovered was that the DNA that is similar to the human genome and therefore likely to come from the Neanderthal is indeed of very short size in there, 40, 50, 60 nucleotides long. Whereas if you extract DNA from a blood sample from me, you will easily have things that are 10, 20,000 nucleotides long. The other thing that became obvious was that in most cases, there is very little endogenous DNA from the Neanderthal there. Our very best bones have something like 3 or 4%. All the rest are then from bacteria and fungi that have grown in the specimen when it was deposited in the cave. We also found out other things, for example, that there are certain modifications in the DNA towards the ends of the molecules. We find very many apparent substitutions from C to T, unreasonably many. And it turned out to be due to chemical modification of one of these bases, C, that loses this chemical group. So it's now misread as T. So those errors occur particularly towards the ends of the molecule, where the molecule is more sensitive to damage from water in the environment. So you can then use them actually as an advantage to say if you have a mixture of contaminating modern molecules and ancient ones, you can sort of focus on only the molecules with such modifications because they have taken at least tens of thousands of years to accumulate. But it's also a problem, of course. These are incorrect mutations, so when you sort of map these molecules to the human genome, you have to take into account that the ends of them are unreliable information. So we looked through many bones, focused on three bones from that Vindhya site, sequenced a bit over a billion DNA molecules from them, most then from bacteria, but enough to sort of in 2010 have a little over half of the Neanderthal genome that we'd seen from at least one ancient fragment. So one of the first questions we were then interested in was what happened there when modern humans came out of Africa and met Neanderthals, did one mix or not with each other? There are several ways to ask that. I'll just mention one, the most direct one, and that is that if Neanderthals would have contributed to the variation in Europeans today, we would expect Europeans to share more genetic variants with Neanderthals than people in Africa. Because there have never been Neanderthals in Africa, there is no reason to assume that they would have any particular similarity to Neanderthals. So we had the Neanderthal genome. To avoid differences in sort of error rate between molecules, we went out and sequenced five present-day people from different parts of the world. We wanted a typical European. To us, that was obviously a person from France, so this is a French genome. We sequenced two individuals from Africa, one from China, one from Papua New Guinea, and then did a very simple test. We just take two present-day people to test this idea, the two Africans. We find all places in the genome where they differ from each other. And then we take the Neanderthal and say, how often does the Neanderthal match this African or that African? And it should be 50-50, right? Since Neanderthals have never been in Africa, there's no reason to assume that the Neanderthal would be closer to one African than another African. And statistically speaking, this is what you find. Equal matching to this African as to that African. Almost 100,000 matches to each. If we now take a European individual and an African individual and do the same thing, what we find, to my surprise actually at the time, was statistically significantly more matching to the European individual than the African individual, suggesting that it was a genetic contribution here. Even more surprising was that when we took a Chinese individual and an African individual, we again find more matching to the Chinese person, although most people would argue there had never been Neanderthals in China. And in Papua New Guinea, again, more matching. So the question sort of became, how could it be that we see a contribution from Neanderthals, not only in Europe where Neanderthals had existed, but also in China and in Papua New Guinea? And the idea we suggested that have since been sort of proven correct by other groups and by further work from us is to suggest that if modern humans come out of Africa, they presumably passed by the Middle East. And we know that there were Neanderthals in the Middle East. And if these early modern humans mix with Neanderthals and then go on to become the ancestors of people in the rest of the non-African world today, they can sort of carry with them a contribution from Neanderthals also to parts of the world where Neanderthals had not existed, to the extent that somewhere between a 1% and 2% of the DNA of people whose roots are outside Africa today come from Neanderthals. What has then happened over the last years is that last year we produced a very good quality Neanderthal genome, and that is really thanks to our collaboration with Russian colleagues, particularly Anatoly Derevyanko, who excavates at a site called the Denisova Cave in southern Siberia, a beautiful area, where they in 2010 found this little toe bone that turned out to come from a Neanderthal. And we had then developed much more sensitive techniques to retrieve DNA that rely on separating the two strands and sequencing them independently. So each double-stranded molecule actually have two chances to end up in our sequencing machines. And this allowed us now to go from a Neanderthal genome where we only cover a little over half of the whole genome by these fragments to a very good genome where we cover every position actually over 50 times over. So we now have a genome where in the parts of the genome that we can match these short part fragments to is of higher quality than most genomes that one would sequence from individuals today. So this now allows us to look in many people. For example, this is just for one chromosome, marking which segments seem to come from Neanderthals on chromosome 9 in many present-day individuals. So you will see most people carry different parts from the Neanderthals, but on average it ends up being somewhere between 1 and 2%. So you may then ask, is that a lot or a little? It's sort of a funny question. What is a lot and what is a little? But just to get a perspective on this, I like sometimes to sort of say, if you think about your own family tree, this is you here. You obviously have 50% of your DNA from your mother and father. You have approximately 25% from your grandparents, each of your grandparents. The next generation back, it will be 12%, 6%, 3%. And six generations back, it will be on average 1.5%. So it sort of is as if you would have a Neanderthal ancestor six generations back, but it could distribute it differently in the genome. This is in small pieces everywhere. If it was an ancestor here, it would be in big pieces. So you may also ask how much of the Neanderthal genome still lives on today in present-day people. So if we jump from person to person here and puzzle together, how much of the Neanderthal genome can we fit together? It's a blue thing here that adds up the things above. And it's a bit unclear still, but somewhere in the order of 40% or so of the Neanderthal genome still exists in people today. Now, when we have a good genome, we can, of course, also do other things. We can distinguish, we can see the two variants that this Neanderthal individual had inherited from its mother and its father. So we can begin to look at variation in that population. So if we look in present-day people, we have Africans here, have more variation, as we already said, than non-Africans. And here, we then have the Neanderthals and the relative of Neanderthals. So they have very little variation. If we looked more closely on this Neanderthal, we found something very surprising. We find long, long stretches on the chromosome, one example here, where the two chromosomes are identical, that they have inherited from the mother and the father. So this obviously means that the parents were closely related with each other, the parents of this individual we have sequenced. So we can then reconstruct how related the parents must have been. It must have been one of these four scenarios. So either the parents were half-sibs, or say grandfather, granddaughter, or don't even ask me what double first cousins are, I can't sort of reconstruct it in my head. But they were clearly closely related. So it will be very interesting in the future, I think, when you get more high-quality Neanderthal genomes to see if this is typical of Neanderthals or something unusual that happened here. What we can also do is then that we can look in certain parts of the genome, compare the two chromosomes in this individual, see how many differences there are in a segment, and reconstruct the time back to the common ancestor. And we can do that for many parts of the genome, and then we can reconstruct sort of the time to common ancestors across the genome in thousands of different regions like this. And this then reflects the population size back over history. So we can reconstruct the variation and the history of the variation from sequencing just one individual, from the fact that that individual carries two copies of the genome. And obviously, the population in the past has been of smaller size when more of these chromosomes segments go back to common ancestors. It would have been a dip in size here. And this is then these plots that Jean-Jacques showed you an example of before. So if we now look, this is a past and this is a present. Present day people, no matter if we live in Africa or Europe and Asia, share a sort of reduction in population size and a growth in population size. And only quite recently do we see a difference where Africans have more variation than non-Africans. And now we can, for the first time, then look on one of these archaic individuals, this Neanderthal individual, and follow its population history. It seems to share this reduction. Then if anything, it's higher in size and then goes down and becomes extinct. So this individual has a very, very different population history in its past compared to anybody that lives around today. What has also happened in the last few years is then that at this site, the Nisowa cave, they also found another small piece of a bone. It's actually a fragment of the last phalanx of a finger of a child. And we were very lucky to be allowed to study this small little bone with our best techniques. It was well enough preserved so we could sequence a good genome from this individual too. And we were very surprised to find that this individual was not closely related to Neanderthals nor to present-day people. It does go back to common ancestor shared with Neanderthals, but Neanderthals then have a long independent history. So after quite some discussion with our Russian colleagues, we decided to call this new group of extinct hominins and Denisovans. So just like Neanderthals are called Neanderthals after the first site where they were found in Neanderthal, these are called Denisovans after Denisova cave where they were found. So if we then look at how different they are from Neanderthals, how far time it goes back to a common ancestor, that's a bit hard to answer. If we look at, say, the deepest divergence between human groups today, so when two African groups that are far from each other have a common ancestor, this now depends on the mutation rate, of course, how fast we think mutations accumulate in the human genome. And the problem is that we're very uncertain of that. Traditionally, one has used certain rates that depend on a paleontological estimate when species had a common ancestor and counting differences between present-day genomes. Now, recently, one has started being able to sequence parents and offspring and actually count mutations between the child that is born and the parents. And those rates then come out as being higher than what we had thought. So if we now believe these rates, and I tend to believe them, then we would estimate the population split in Africa among the deepest splits somewhere here 100,000 years ago in time or so. So by comparison, if we now look at Neanderthals from the Denisovans, they are then 400,000 or even a bit more. So even if these rates are now wrong, so this is wrong in years, the relationship here will remain. This will be something like four times deeper than the deepest split we see between people today. And the common ancestor then in this scheme between present-day people and Neanderthals is somewhere 500,000 or 600,000 or even 700,000 years back. So these ages are then older than the ones you saw on Jean-Jacques' diagrams, because they were based on these older rates that I wouldn't tend to believe anymore. So have Denisovans mixed with modern humans? Yes, it turns out they have, and they have particularly contributed surprisingly in the Pacific. So in people in Papua New Guinea, Aboriginal Australians, although the bone was found in Siberia. So this obviously makes us suspect that the Denisovans were more widespread in the past and maybe met the ancestors of present-day people out here somewhere in Southeast Asia. And the contribution is actually quite large, something like 5% or so, so 3-4 times more than the contribution from Neanderthals. So if I would just summarize this part before coming towards the end, about what we think we know then from studying genomes about the origin of Neanderthals and Denisovans, I would guess then that the origins of them are somewhere in Africa in something called Homo rhodesiensis or Heidelbergensis or what you like, more than 500,000 years ago, and they evolve in Western Eurasia to something we call Neanderthals, in Eastern Eurasia to something we call Denisovans then. This is not at all to say that they were this widespread or that they were the only forms of humans living there. The only thing we really know is that some point in time there were Denisovans in the Altai Mountains here. At some other time were Neanderthals there. We know there were other forms in Indonesia, for example, present also when modern humans then start spreading in the order of 50,000 years ago. And they then mixed with Neanderthals, presumably in the Middle East. They continue to spread. And there is now good evidence that there is additional admixture with Neanderthals in the ancestors of people in Asia. Because Asians today actually have slightly more Neanderthal contribution than people in Europe. About 20% more, so say instead of 1%, 1.2%. There is mixture with Denisovans, presumably somewhere in Southeast Asia. People continue out in the Pacific. These other forms become extinct, but then live on, if you like, a little bit in that 1 to 2% Neanderthal DNA, and on top of that, something like 5% in the Pacific. I wouldn't be surprised if in the future one found other groups that had contributed in China, or indeed in Africa when modern humans spread across Africa. So a take-home lesson from this is that we have always mixed with other groups, at least a little bit. And recently we've sort of gotten more evidence of that when we studied a site in Romania, a mandible created by the devil in Romania, that is around 40,000 years old and looks like a modern human with some archaic traits. We studied the DNA in this specimen, and it's rather little endogenous DNA, much less than 1%. So we've actually used special techniques we developed to fish out that DNA, believe only the fragments with these C to T substitutions in the ends. And if we now look on one chromosome as an example here in some present-day humans and some ancient modern humans, marking in color the segments of the DNA on the chromosome that comes from Neanderthals. And now we look at the 40,000-year-old modern human from Romania, and we find a lot more. And not only that, where there are sort of black parts here are actually parts of the genome that we don't look at because we can't sort of map regions there. So this is presumably a solid piece of Neanderthal DNA here. Over half of this chromosome comes from a Neanderthal. So if we do this genome-wide, we can find several such huge regions that come from Neanderthals. So we can then estimate that this individual must have had a recent Neanderthal ancestor in its family tree. And indeed, we can show that 6, 5, or 4 generations back, this individual had a Neanderthal ancestor. So we sort of almost caught someone 40,000 years ago in the act, if you like. So we then know there is additional mixture here. So the big picture is then that yes, modern humans come out of Africa. They replace these other forms, but there is some contribution from these earlier forms. I would be surprised if we ever find any present-day people that would be close to 10% of archaic contribution. But so to have the perspective of this, sort of often like to call this sort of leaky replacement. The big picture is one of replacement of these other forms, but there is a small contribution from these other individuals then. So what I would then like to discuss for a little while is, does this mean anything for present day people? Does it have any functional consequences that we carry, some of us, Neanderthal or Denisovan DNA? Well, so what you can now do is you can go over the genomes of many hundreds of European people or Asian people and find where there are segments of the genome that many people in Europe, say over 50% or so, carry from Neanderthals, or even 70-80%. You will see that some of these are shared in Asia and Europe, some are unique to Asians, some unique to Europeans. So if you just ask what genes are located in such regions that have come to high frequency as if they were advantageous for people, it's a rather boring answer. The genes that are statistically more there than you would expect are keratins. These are structural proteins in your skin or in the hair. So when we understand this in the future, we'll probably learn that something about how skin and hair functions or looks in Europeans and Asians come from Neanderthals. More interestingly, a group in Stanford has shown that genes involved in immune defense against infectious diseases, some variants of such genes, come from Neanderthals and come from Denisovans. So something in how one deals with infectious diseases seem to be coming from Neanderthals. A group in China has shown that genes involved in how we degrade lipids are particularly frequently coming from Neanderthals in Europe and not so in Asia. We don't understand what this is, but something in lipid metabolism in many Europeans seem to be influenced by this. And even more striking, there was an American group that showed last year that a lipid transporter, so a protein that transports lipids into cells, that a variant of this gene encoding this confers risk for type 2 diabetes, so the type of diabetes you get at old age. And it then turned out that this risk variant is particularly frequent in Asia and Native Americans, that it comes from Neanderthals. So it may be surprising that something that causes disease today, that causes diabetes today, would come from Neanderthals and rise to high frequency. But I think it's sort of a good example probably about that a disease is sort of the interaction between your genes and the environment. It's good reason to assume that variants that give you diabetes today, when you have ample nutrition your whole life, may actually be advantageous in other situations where you have starvation or periodic starvation. So it may be that what we see here is some Neanderthal adaptation to starvation that came over to modern humans and rose to high frequency. And perhaps the most interesting example of things coming from these archaic groups comes from Tibet. At the high plateau in Tibet, it was already known that people are adapted to living at so high altitudes that there is little oxygen there in the atmosphere. People who move there tend to have many complications in pregnancy, for example. And it was known that there's a particular gene here that is a variant of that gene is responsible for that adaptation. And a group at Berkeley has shown that that gene variant is very frequent in Tibet, very rare at other places in Asia, and that that variant comes over to the ancestor of Tibetans from Denisovans. So it's quite interesting that we would probably not have so large populations in Tibet today if it wasn't for this contribution from Denisovans. So it's a sort of concept coming out, sort of suggesting that these groups had lived in Eurasia for hundreds of thousands of years, would have adapted to the local environment in forms of infectious diseases or what have you. And then comes these modern humans from Africa, mix a bit with these local people, pick up some genetic variants, and when they are advantageous, they come to rise to high frequency. So it's something that one in animal sort of ecology often calls adaptive integration, but that hasn't been so sort of emphasized in the history of modern humans. Something that, so, and I think in the next 2 years, we will learn a lot more about what this contribution means when people now automatically start comparing variants they find to the Neanderthal and Denisovan genomes to see if it might have come over from them. But something that I find almost more interesting is to say what has not been contributed by Neanderthals and Denisovans to modern humans. We can now go over the genome, all the chromosomes here, and look for areas where we would statistically expect a contribution from Neanderthals, but we don't see it. It is as if we select against it in those regions. And why are those parts of the genome interesting? Well, I think they're interesting because there may be genetic variants hiding that really are responsible for functions unique to modern humans. So things that have changed since we separated from Neanderthals and come to be prevalent or present in all present-day people, no matter if we live in Africa, Asia, or Europe. Why would that be interesting? Well, I think that at least after some time, from 50, 60,000 years on, modern humans are, of course, having a very special history. Technology starts changing very rapidly. Figurative art appears in modern humans, and modern humans start expanding in population size, expanding across water, expanding to all habitable part of the planet, to the extent that we are billions of people today, right, and influence large parts of the biosphere. So one can, of course, a dream would be to say that in this catalogue of things that are present in the human genome and not the Neanderthal genome would hide the biological basis for that. So if we are very strict and say we require genetic variants to be present as far as we can tell in all present-day people today, not in Neanderthals, Denisovans, and apes, as have happened there, then that list is not very long. It's just a little over 30,000 changes. You can look through that in an hour or two in your computer. The problem is one doesn't understand what one looks at. Problem is we are very, very bad at inferring function from any particular genetic change. One can, of course, try to say that things that change amino acids in proteins, for example, are more likely to be important, or things that regulate the activity of genes are more important. So you can look at proteins that have changed. You may be particularly interested in those expressed in the brain, since you might think that cognitively it's something special with modern humans. And I think that's the challenge for the next 10 years or so of research, to now use these genomes to try to figure out these things. You may then ask, how would one go about studying human-specific changes? And I think over the past 5 years, I've gone around and joked when I give talks, saying, what we would like to do is make transgenic humans that we put Neanderthal genetic variants into and then study them. We'd like to do transgenic chimps where we put human variants in and study them. And of course, we cannot do that for many, many reasons, ethical reasons and other reasons. But it's sort of less of a joke now, because now there are other people that go around, even professors at Harvard, who go around and say, we should do much more than this. We should clone Neanderthals. We should now use the genome we have and engineer a human stem cell and have a Neanderthal born. And there are, of course, many technical reasons we can discuss, and of course, ethical reasons that make that even more impossible than the others suggested. But what is not just a joke, sort of what can we hope to do in the future to not just end in speculation about what this would be? I think one thing that will be possible in the future is to actually look for back mutations in present-day people. Because in a future that's perhaps 5 or 10 years away, where everyone will have their whole genome sequenced as soon as they go to the doctor, we will have millions and millions of genome sequences and medical records. And I already told you that each baby that's born have 100 or 200 new mutations that are not there in the mother or father. And there are 7 billion people on the planet, each have 2 genomes, each with 100 mutations, and the genome is just 3 billion nucleotides. So every mutation compatible with human life exists out there in the population. Most of them are just very rare. But I think in the future, one can imagine that we will be able to find back mutations to the ancestral state in people, and that it will become ethically possible to study that. But that's then really a bit into the future. What we can also imagine to do now is to engineer changes in stem cells and then study in vitro a liver cell or a neuron that we differentiate from these cells. Or we can put these things into transgenic mice. I just want to show you one example of that where we have worked a lot over the last few years as an example of where one might then go in the future. It's this one gene on chromosome 7 called FOXP2. This gene, when it is damaged in present-day people, you have a severe language problem that allowed a group in Britain, Tony Monaco's group, to isolate this gene. And interestingly, the protein encoded by it carries 2 human-specific changes that is there in humans and not in the great apes. So we were, of course, very interested when we got the Neanderthal genome and the Denisovan genome to say, what variants did they carry? So this is the position where chimpanzees and humans differ. The Neanderthals and the Denisovans turned out to be like modern humans, like present-day people. So these changes obviously happened here before the separation. So whatever these changes do, it's shared with Neanderthals. But we were nevertheless interested in this. So we then put these changes, the human changes, into a mouse gene. So you sort of humanize endogenous mouse gene. It now makes from its own FOXP2 gene, makes essentially the human protein with just one other probably unimportant change there. So what you end up is having a mouse with these 2 changes that you think might have something to do with speech and language. And you're faced with your next problem. How do you teach a mouse to speak? So what we did notice, though, to my amazement, was that this mouse did vocalize a bit differently. It peeped slightly differently, not in any more human-like way, but differently. You can also then study neurons in the cell. You can actually find that neurons in certain parts of the brain make longer dendrites and axons, so longer connections to other neurons in the humanized mice. They also have slightly different electrophysiological properties. And this is particularly the case in parts of the brain circuits that have to do with motor learning, learning of motor behaviors. So more recently, a previous graduate student from our lab has worked at MIT on motor learning in these mice. And she showed last year that in certain learning tasks where the mouse has to go in a labyrinth to get a reward and get a cue, a visual cue, for example, of where to go, and then you can take away the cue. So if the mouse sort of gets a light signal that it should always turn to the left to get chocolate milk here, after a while you can take away the signal and the mouse have internalized, I should always go to the left. That switch to doing it automatically, the humanized mice learn in 7 to 8 days, whereas the wild type littermates born by the same mother take 11, 12 days to learn the same thing. So that goes together with movement of this activity from another part of the brain. And it's the same, I'm not a neurobiologist really, but it's the same switch that happens in the brain, for example, if you think when you learn to bike as a kid. When you first learn to bike, you think about what you do and you're very bad at it, right? I've turned to this, I should turn like that. And then comes a point where you suddenly stop thinking about what you do. You do it automatically, and you become very good at biking. And that is sort of the switch from the declarative to procedure learning that these mice do quicker. So the current hypothesis then about these changes is that they somehow change circuits in the brain that make for faster automation of motor learning, and that this may have something to do then with aspect of particular speech, because it's very tempting to speculate that one of the most sophisticated motor coordination, motor learning we learn, is when we learn to coordinate our vocal cords, our lips, our tongues, to produce articulation. So I think this is sort of an encouraging example of that one might in the future be able to study many of these genes that have interesting human-specific changes, for example, in a mouse model, but also in stem cell models. And just to end then, I wanted to come to the question, well, we've now gone back to Neanderthals and Denisovans, how far back in time do we think we can go? And the challenge here, that's where our group work a lot now, is to try to push these techniques to even further back in time. The challenge is that as you go back in time, the fragment size of the DNA you have tend to get shorter and shorter. So we have worked a lot on methods to allow these really short fragments to be retrieved so we can sequence them, whereas other methods get less and less efficient the shorter you get. These new methods now stay the same. Well, these methods I mentioned based on looking at single strands of DNA rather than double-stranded DNA. And we have then applied it to this site that Jean-Jacques mentioned, Cima del Huesos in Spain, where you find these hominins around more than 400,000 years old that you may call Homo heidelbergensis or something else. It's a deep cave site where you find many, many bones, and we were allowed first to work on this femur and then on other specimens. We first focused again on this mitochondrial DNA, just to give you a feeling for how much work this is. We sequence around 500 million DNA molecules from this femur to, in the end, use something like 10, 15,000 of those fragments to reconstruct the mitochondrial genome. And that mitochondrial genome, quite surprisingly here, turned out to share an ancestor far back with the mitochondrial DNA of Denisovans and not with the Neanderthals. That is quite surprising then, that this would sort of far back share a common ancestor with something in Siberia rather than the Neanderthals in Europe. So it has been quite clear that we need to go to the nuclear genome, so that's what we have worked on over the last year. We now have two specimens here where we have retrieved at least 1 million, and in the other case, 2 million nucleotides, so we can begin to address these questions. So if we now look at the lineage here in the nuclear genome to the Denisovan and to the Neanderthal, if we look at other Neanderthals we sequenced, they fall along here in the lineage, and these are these CIMA specimens that fall quite a bit further back, but clearly on the Neanderthal lineage. So if this is 430,000 years ago, this would look like two-thirds back to the common ancestor with the Denisovans, this would be much closer. So they are clearly on the Neanderthal lineage. We would tend to say we would call them Neanderthals then, rather than Homo heidelbergensis, I think, in agreement with what you said. Where does the mitochondrial DNA come from? That is still then a big question. Either there was a lot of mitochondrial variation back here that happened to survive to here and here, or this indeed comes by gene flow from something else into these groups. But the exciting thing, I think, is that the techniques are now getting so good. So earlier I've always said we will be within the last 100,000 years of studying hominin evolution. Maybe we can now begin to dream about going back within the last 1 million years or so with this. So with that, I then hope I have convinced you about that if you're interested in human evolution, particularly recent human evolution, it's very good to have the genomes of our closest extinct relatives, because you can look on what's unique to present-day humans. In the future, when we have more Neanderthal genomes, and we will soon have, I think, more Neanderthal genomes, we can also begin to look on what's unique to Neanderthals. But the next interesting question then for this is really to go to the functional level, to understand what some of these changes meant. And for that, I think then, engineering in changes in human stem cells and study their effects will be interesting, and also to humanize mice, as I've sort of suggested. Should say that many, many people help with this. Many people that contribute fossils to our work. Some of the most important ones are mentioned here. Many people help in the laboratory. Too many people to mention. I just mentioned one person, Matthias Meyer, who invented this method of using single strands to make DNA libraries. Without his work, we would not have the high quality Neanderthal and Denisovan genomes that are now so important. Many, many people have helped analyzing the genomes. Particularly, I should mention Janet Kelso and Kai Prüfer, who sort of coordinate all the computer work in our lab. And with that, I then thank you for your attention.